I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask out of all my prayer. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Apple baby fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about films from 1989 from a bowl of cereal here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Neibart.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And with us today is our best and favorite guest who we only give the best movies
we
to.
We only give him the best movies.
From the You're Missing Out podcast and our famous episode on Pokemon. It's Michael Natale.
Pokemon.
Hi, guys. Thank you. Thank you for having me back. Thank you for that intro. That makes up for how much glowing praise you laid on my co-host at the end of the American Pimp episode.
I love that bastard.
Ten minutes of lavish praise. Which, can I say my favorite part of that whole speech you guys go on? So you guys are going on about Tom and how wonderful he is because Tom actually showed up.
He's wonderful.
He showed up for your show and he was prepared as opposed to our show where he's like David Letterman in the last year he was doing Late Night where he just rolls. He's like, what are we talking about? Who's this person? I don't know. Whatever. Just roll.
sure.
But what I love is that Phil is going, you know, Tom is just like a wealth of knowledge of these films. And Kenny goes, yeah, him and Mike, they both are. And Phil goes, yeah, but Tom... And just goes,
I don't remember doing that. If I did that, then that's shitty of me. I would never do something like that.
That is so you, though.
It's possible.
but it is true that you both are, and I know Phil would agree. It is true you both are, and you know. Phil just has this thing about podcast co-hosts. He assumes they're bitter rivals the way we are. He assumed that Tom didn't want to hear anything positive about it.
I want to explain myself just a little bit here, okay? Because there's something about Tom.
This is exactly how we started the last episode, too.
No, but I just want to be very clear. I do. I think that the reason that we were talking about Tom, first of all, is
you're
he was the
good,
guest that was coming
Tom.
Up. You're fantastic, Mike. Obviously, we love you. That should go without saying. My point when we were talking about Tom is this: the specificity of his knowledge is what I find kind of astounding. Like, there's a lane that he just owns where your knowledge is far more broad in terms of that you're able to speak about more.
Both great guys. Two great guys. Yeah. So great together.
Well, that's, I think...
Peanut butter and chocolate.
I think what it is you describe Tom as an iconoclast with controversial opinions, whereas you get mad at me for mine. And I think the difference is that Tom has really strong opinions that you, Phil, could not give a shit about. And I have really strong opinions sometimes on movies that you really like. Like, if Tom goes off on JCVD, I don't think you're really going, hang on a second, buddy. But, you know.
There's some legitimacy to that. I think there's, I think that if anything, that means that I perhaps, that your opinion, you know, hits closer to home. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, listen, I love Tom. He's been my co-host for a long time. He's not firing off any hot takes on, like, 20th century women anytime soon. I don't see that, you know.
He's not. But we do look forward to having him come on to talk about 1989. He's great.
We
look forward to that. He's great.
Oh, we know. Trust me. Again, guys, so the funny. Last 10 minutes of American Pimp, just laying it on. Fucking laying it on.
Is that what?
Kenny would kick me off the podcast just to do a podcast with Tom. That's the impression that I get.
But you. I that's how I feel.
Anybody else?
You guys, both of you guys are twice the podcaster that Phil is. So, the point is, I am here just for the laughs. I'm trying to sit back, crack jokes. You know, I noticed over the course of this podcast, 1999, that there's a running joke that I hope no one else has picked up on. But the running joke is at the end when we rate the movies, I never seen any of these movies. Phil's like, so back in 99, when I saw this movie in the theater, I'm like, I didn't even know this existed. I am not the cinephile I thought I was now that I've entered the world of film Twitter. So what I have to be is a bit of a clown. And what I need is a really strong cinephile across from me. That's what you and Tom are. End of sentence.
End of sentence. So here we are talking about everyone's favorite 1989 movie, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. So Mike,
mm-hmm.
you dug deep on this film. And I can say, I think I can speak for both of us when I say that Kenny and I are unbelievably thrilled that you watched every single episode of the television show based on this film.
Correct.
All 66 episodes, I believe, is what you said that
correct.
You watched.
And by the way, don't think that
Kenny's face right now is unreal.
Now,
so he did that.
Look, hang on, Phil, before you go on, Phil, before you go on, I want to make sure I lower your listeners' expectations. When we did Pokemon, obviously I did an obsessive amount of research and I showed up with the hat and the t-shirt and the polyworld glass. And to be honest, I don't have that level of dedication to Honey. Hang on. I'm a little parched. Let me just grab a drink from this.
For our listeners, he just raised a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids cup.
This is premium. Make them pay for it.
This
pay
is
the $10 a month.
Content. You can pay for this shit.
If you're only paying the $5, you don't get to know what I'm holding.
Can I just say, though? I am like 95% sure I had that cup when I was a kid.
Oh, did you
just seeing that now, I just was like, wait a second. I think I had that cup.
I mean, that's the only thing I can do. I mean, by the way, how do I look? Would it help if I wore this Honey, I Shrunk the Audience pin from Disneyland? Or will that not show up well? Would it be better if I wore the Honey, I Shrunk the Audience pin from Disneyland Paris, guys?
This is... God.
Oh, and sorry.
Kenny's face. Just slapped on.
I appreciate the sight gags, but if any of our listeners are over the 66 episodes of the television show you watched, they're stronger than I.
You mean the syndicated television show? Check your local listings for showtimes.
Oh my God!
They did a deep fake with Moranis.
Are you having trouble?
Who is that man?
That's Scolari.
Peter Scolari.
Peter Scolari?
Wait, hang on, Kenny. Are you having trouble seeing? Because I have the postcard. That's a bigger image right there. Yeah. Does that help?
There it is.
If you can see.
That's Peter Scolari.
Yeah, that's Peter Scolari.
So I understand Peter Scolari and Tom Hanks are still friends.
Mm-hmm. They are.
If you were Peter Scolari, would you be friends with Tom Hanks?
Yes.
I wouldn't.
Can I skip ahead real quick and share one note that I have from the TV show viewing?
Please.
Give me one sec.
Garfunkel is friends with Simon.
Well, Garfunkel is very sick right now. I don't know that he's still, he's having his own issues.
I believe, let me see if I can find the exact thing I have here.
It's true.
Oh my God. Where the hell? I've been taking notes on each episode out of curiosity. I make the note that, at one point in this episode, Wayne is sliding on the grass and he strikes his genitals on a tree and makes a big oof noise. This same year, at this same time, Tom Hanks was starring in Saving Private Ryan. So it's these little observations that I wanted to make along the way.
Oh, Scolari's great on girls, guys.
No, don't get me wrong. Watching this show, and I mean this sincerely, I am so fascinated by Peter Scolari. I have a great deal of appreciation for Scolari. I actually really like the cast on this show. I was so curious what it was like working on the show that what if I told you my research went a little bit deeper, guys? What if I told you...
I mean, I don't know how that's possible, but
what,
sure.
What if
Scolari in studio?
What, no.
Yeah, do you have him on?
Not Scolari, but fellas, what if I told you I was so curious about why they replaced the dog between seasons one and seasons two that I purchased a cameo from Barbara Allen Woods from One Tree Hill, the actress who played the mom on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And if you guys want, I'll send it over. I have a 3.5-minute video of Barbara Allen Woods answering questions about you Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, the television series.
You have to send that to us. This, I mean, honestly,
there are no more guests.
There's no more guests, and also there's nowhere to go from here. We've peaked, and it's only 5 minutes into the episode. There's nowhere to go. You dropped all the good shit.
Bill, we haven't even touched on the Tommy Westfall cinematic universe at all. Phil, I have so many pages.
We will.
There are more pages here than I have Pokemon. My life is empty. It's been a year. Yeah.
This is like... For the people that listen to our podcast and also listen to Blank Check, you're becoming our JD Amato, which is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Except I don't have
the person who goes so deep.
JD Amato wishes he was Mike Natale.
That's true.
He might. Director and technically knowledgeable JD Amato wishes he was unemployed Mike Natale.
I agree.
You don't know if JD Amato's employed.
Technically knowledgeable. You are actually knowledgeable.
True. It's true.
No, I meant he's knowledgeable with tech stuff. Whereas I just know.
I knew what you meant. Yes. I knew what you meant. So, I was being complimentary.
So just to try to get this back on something close to rails.
Because it's going 1989, off many
times. Yeah. I'm sure it is. In 1989, did you watch this movie? Had you seen this movie? Were you quite young in 89, I'm assuming, right? You were like...
So in 1989, I was a zygote. I was born in July of 1990.
Okay.
I did see the film growing up. I grew up with it. I'd seen all of them. By the way, before we talk about the TV show, let me just acknowledge, yes, of course I watched Honey, I Blew Up the Kid and Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves as well.
Yeah, no, there's evidence. There's Kerry Russell evidence on Twitter that you watched that. Honey, I Blew Up.
I didn't even realize there was a show.
No, and actually, speaking of which, you know, I got in touch with the mom from the TV show, but I actually got in touch with one of the cast members from Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves too. Her name is Allison Mack, and she has a great self-help group that she's invited me to join.
Oh.
So we're going to have a lot of fun.
She's very communicative, I hear, these days.
Yeah. You know.
Oh, man.
Did you watch Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves as well?
You asking me?
Did you watch that one too?
Yes. Me?
Yes, Mike. Phil, did you watch Honey, I Shrunk Ourselves?
Phil, why would I watch 66 episodes of the TV show and then go, there's one more movie. Should I watch it? Nah. Yeah, of course I watched it.
Okay.
You want me to get yelled at in the Reddit? I watched it. I came prepared.
So you watched this movie when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
At some point in your childhood, you watched this film.
Yeah.
Did it? I mean, what sort of impression did it leave? Did you enjoy it as a kid? I mean, I haven't watched this film since I was probably 9 or 10 years old, so I have not. I, I, I'm curious to hear what Kenny has to say. I don't know, Kenny, if you watched this with your kids. Did you watch this with your kids?
Yes.
Okay. I'm curious what their thoughts are on it as well.
I watched this. This is a movie that, you know, I showed my kids earlier in their lives because it's friendly. And last night, I watched it with both of the older ones. And they both, you know, they both watched it kind of kicking and screaming. They were not into it at all. And Rollins, my son, threw a fit after the movie because he wasted his screen time on a movie that sucks. So, he said he only gets so much screen time. And he's sitting on his bed going, I can't believe I wasted my screen time on a movie that sucks. It sucks. It sucks. So he thinks it sucks.
Wow. And I'll tell you, I always thought this movie was pretty good. But watching last night, I don't think Rollins is like that wrong.
Yeah, Rollins isn't that far off.
I think it kind of sucks. Am I wrong?
Well, here's what became abundantly. Well, can I just say very quickly?
I want to say one more thing. Okay. I know it's not. I know I believe that the conventional wisdom is that this movie is not a product of nostalgia.
Yeah.
Not a persistence of memory thing, but is an actual good movie. It is not. This is not an actual good movie. This is at best a nostalgic movie, and it. In a vacuum, it's a pretty bad movie. That's
well. Here from 30,000 feet. I want to answer kind of both your questions, Kenny. The first is, I fully agree with you that it is a project of nostalgia, as to why people have fond feelings of this film. I also think that the Joe Johnson thing. This was his first film. We should talk about Joe Johnson at some point, just in terms of kind of his
it's better
career.
Than his other film we've done. But
wow, you like this more than October Sky?
Much, much more. But wow. October Sky that movie stinks.
All right, well, we'll talk about that in a second. But I think that this film definitely has the nostalgia effect. I went into this film having not seen this film since I was probably 10 years old. So I went into it exactly the way you're thinking or talking about it, Kenny, of this like, I remember that it was kind of fun and cool, and it was a silly adventure kind of movie, whatever. It's a one-gag movie. It's a good gag. It's a solid gag, but it's a thin gag. So it's just like at a certain point, there's not a lot of there because the cutaways to the parents, half the time they don't even know that the kids are small, and then when they do, they can't really do anything about it. The idea of like looking in blades of grass with a microscope is insane. It would have taken them like a million years for them to find these kids. Like it's all kind of like it's from a storytelling perspective, Kenny, it is a bad script is ultimately what you're saying. I think
it's a surprisingly limited premise.
Yes. Yes.
That I didn't expect necessarily.
Correct.
But it is a pretty limited premise. And you know, initially when I went to this movie expecting to like it, I was thinking, oh, how wonderful this whole movie takes place within the context of their backyard and all the adventures they get in. There are no adventures. They find a cookie.
Well, no, their lives are in danger on several different occasions.
A little bit, right? A little bit. But this isn't this doesn't build on the bit the way you'd expect a movie like this to build on the bit, and it could also build on the bit with the parents that we are talking about. I don't think it's a terrible movie, but I do think that it's like it was woefully disappointing.
I agree with you 100% that fundamentally they never really dug beneath the surface of the idea. Because to your point, like there's all sorts of stuff they should have been doing in the backyard. There's all sorts of, you know, quote unquote story that could be done there, but instead really what they're doing is just they're little, so they could drown in rain, or they could, you know, like they don't go far enough with it. But I also just feel like I really enjoyed watching it last night because of the way it looked. Like it's such a tactile movie. I love that they built this shit. When I think about
that's the good like, stuff.
What I was hoping is that Mike was going to show up with one of the giant Cheerios that he somehow found on eBay or something like that. But I ultimately
now
give it some time. But I just want to say this. I think that That shit's fucking gold. Throwing Robert Oliveri, is that how you say his name, I think, into a tank of milk-like substance with giant Cheerios is the goods, right? Like, I love that stuff. So the movie kind of worked for me on a purely aesthetic level. But to your point, Kenny, on a story level, it's kind of shit.
All right, Mike, jump in here.
I want to touch on a couple things. One, when I revisited this film, I ended up finding myself appreciating it a lot more as an object and a curio rather than a full film. That's Quark. That's Kenny actually brought
that's
in Quark the dog.
Yes, it's
Kenny, Quark the dog. Kenny got Quark.
Right. Who is played by one dog in the movies and then another dog in the first season of the show, and then they replace him with a different breed of dog in the second season. It's very weird.
Weird. Do we know why they did that?
I asked Barbara Allen Woods this very question, and she said she didn't know. Okay, well, I tried.
Lazy.
I have been trying. No, because they go through a lot to replace. They do a whole episode about why the dog's breed changes because of a Zelensky machine. We can't even touch on Zelenskyum that powers the machines. Because I don't know if you know this, the shrink ray that Wayne uses in this movie, we find out in the show.
Zelenskyum.
Yeah, well, it's powered by Zelenskyum, which he got from a meteorite that an alien gave him because he rescued the alien in the Wild West.
Stop it.
Stop it. This is 100% real. 66 episodes.
See, this
still.
I just want to say something, and this is slightly off topic, but I just need to say it. When you that little bit of mythological information that you just dropped on us, I tried to watch Transformers The Last Night today.
Yeah.
A cinematic universe that makes not a lick of fucking sense.
Yes.
Like, I don't care. They cannot explain it. And it's just, you know, shoehorning shit in. That screams the same thing where it's like, well, I mean, we got a shrinking machine. Why not fucking involve like time travel and shit? I hate shit like that. Anyway, just keep going.
No, Phil, I love when you watch things like that. I went out of my way. I bought you a movie just because I wanted you to grapple with it. Like years ago, I bought you a copy of XXX, The Return of Xander Cage.
Yeah, it's on my shelf.
You have not
Shrink
watched it yet.
But still on my shelf.
Gotta grapple.
Yeah. Gotta grapple. sorry, I cut you off.
No,
you said
that's fine.
The Zelenskyum.
What I'm saying is it's a fascinating curio, that movie, because it represents it's an important movie in a lot of ways. Truthfully, it is not just Joe Johnston, not just special effects, not just things people single it out for, but it comes at that perfect time, 1989, when Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg and all of them have taken over the Walt Disney Company. And there's a real effort to try and rediscover what that brand means. Now, I'm a big Disney history buff. I'm fascinated by it, and not in the nostalgic, like, oh golly gosh, you know, the fun in the ears, but because as a company and as a piece of film history and American history, it's fascinating. It is the only major studio that still has a really strong sense of identity in the way that, like, you go back to the 30s and you've got, like, oh, MGM, they're musicals. Universal, they're horror and sci-fi, this and that. And Disney, he's the animated, he's the family stuff. And now, so many studios, if you went, what makes a Universal movie, or what makes this, they're all so four quadrant. That effort by Eisner, after he takes over for Ron Miller, to kind of go, let's get back to what this studio is. I don't care if they're all home runs. I want to make stuff that feel familiar. With Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, we need to note that this movie comes in as a pitch from Stuart Gordon, the director of Reanimator and From Beyond, a horror filmmaker. And the studio kind of takes the script and pushes it to be more in line with the stretch.
A script called Teeny Weenies?
Teeny Weenies, was the original title. That was even the working title while they were shooting it. The crew members had badges that said Teeny Weenies on it. Before you left, there's a show on Disney Plus called Prop Culture. There's a whole episode with this guy going through the props of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. That's the only reason I know that. Disney decides they're going to take this and they're going to pivot it in the direction of, and this is what you see when you watch it, this movie is a blend of the movies that Gordon was obviously riffing on, like the 50s films like Attack of the Puppet People and The Incredible Shrinking Man, but then also this real throwback to the classic Disney films that come in at the end of the 50s with Fred McMurray, things like Shaggy Dog, a lot of Absent-Minded Professor. And so what I see when I watch,
also I would say the adventure films of the 50s, right? Yeah. The kids stuff is all that adventure films. Yep.
Swiss Family Robinson, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Treasure Island, that, like, all this, you know, kids on their own trying to figure it out on their own. So I got a strong whiff of what you're talking about as well, Mike.
So I find it fascinating as a course correction for the company. I think it's an important film in that direction of kind of going, how do we get back to what we did right? And Little Mermaid is the biggest example of that in 89, of course, everybody points to that. But I do look at Honey, I Shrunk the Kids as a case of like, okay, let's try and do the kind of movies that we used to do. And, you know, that's with Disney now, they're not really doing that. They don't have the same live action output. They're doing a lot of live action remakes. They do take big swings once in a while, and nobody goes to see them unless you're me and you have a Nutcracker in the Four Realms pin set. Also directed by Joe Johnston. Let's just note, shout out. But I think it's
well, no. half directed by Joe
Johnston. Yes. He did two of the realms, and Leslie Alstrom did the other two. No, yes.
Have you had an opportunity to opine on Nutcracker and the Four Realms on podcast before?
No. No one invites me on for things.
Go ahead and do it.
You should do it because I want to be sold on it, because I actually kind of want to watch it, and I'm curious if I should.
I've seen it twice.
Oh, I really?
It's certainly not nothing. And I understand why Michael, as a big Wild Wild West fan, likes it, because visually it's as if like the steampunky stuff from the Wild Wild West part became sentient and became its own movie. Yeah.
It's also an element of
it's not uncool. I think it's kind of cool.
No, and I also
check it out. I'm going
to
watch it.
I love the fact that, to me, like, I watched it, and, you know, so many movies you watch, and you like, so many movies we see, some of the Transformers films in particular, you go, this feels like an 8-year-old boy wrote it. And Nutcracker in the Four Realms is the only big budget movie I've seen that feels like they brought an 8-year-old girl in a room and went, what do you want to see? Like, what? Just write a story.
That's true.
What? Okay, we took you to the ballet last week. You're making up your own story about it. Okay, so we're going to have the pretty fairy woman played by Keira Knightley, and she's doing a voice that no director should have let happen, but two did. Helen Mirren has a whip and a weird bunch of circus henchmen. I saw that shit in 3D opening weekend just so I could get this little promotional key from AMC, because, again, my life has nothing else going on in it. And in 3D, I found it brilliant. Not that I love the movie, but like they have oh my God, I'm blanking on her name, the ballet dancer. Oh God, it's in the movie.
Yeah, Misty Copeland.
Misty Copeland do a full ballet sequence in 3D, and I was like, oh, this is how this should be done forever. We should just film ballets in 3D and put them on screens. I love it.
I'm looking up the four realms right now.
Get what you're saying because like, all right, so I've said on this podcast that I think Cats is, you know, an abomination, and the only thing worse than Cats is this cult of Cats that's pretending like that's pretending like in some way this was like, you know, this is fun. This is a bunch of people looking for something, grasping for something to get excited about. It's all garbage in the worst possible version of what could have been, which would have been trash no matter what. Nutcracker and the Four Realms should be that. Like, Nutcracker in the Four Realms is actually endlessly fascinating and interesting and weird, and all the decisions come from a place of like, okay, I see, like, for instance, what you're talking about. The, you know, that is Gene Kelly in Singing in the Rain. Like, there is some thought behind what they're trying to do, and something grandiose. It's just it doesn't coalesce in any real way, but at least it's like fun and weird and thrilling and like what is going on now, as opposed to like Cats was just kind of, it just kind of feels like people are like, I desperately want this to be my thing, and it's a bad, stupid thing.
Well, can I just say
don't defend the cult of Cats.
I'm not going to defend the cult of Cats. Right. Two very quick things. The first is, you talking about Nutcracker and the Four Realms, first of all, does make me want to watch it. And I am going to watch it either later Morgan, today or this
Morgan
weekend.
Morgan Freeman gives a performance that people pretend Ian McKellen.
No, but I guess what I want to kind of say is I look at a film like Nutcracker and the Four Realms, which I guess is akin to something like a Jupiter Ascending or even a Treasure Planet, you know, it a is, thing it where is. It where is. It's just like we gave someone a shitload of money and they made something spectacular that just didn't connect, right? Or we weren't really sure how to market it or whatever the case might be, it didn't work. Now, the thing with Cats, however, not that this is a podcast about Cats or any of these movies for that matter, but I think that the thing about Cats is that, and I've caught it a couple times on HBO because, you know, they keep cycling it around on there. It's hauntingly sort of hypnotizing because of how wrong it is. What you're saying about Nutcracker or Treasure Planet or Jupiter Ascending, those are all swings. Those are all people that are aiming for a thing. They might not hit the brass ring, but they're aiming for a thing. Cats doesn't even feel like it's aiming for a thing because it's just so misguided from inception that you're just like, you're watching this thing being like, how did this mutant thing happen? Now, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, well, the reason we're talking about all these films in concert with this film is that we all wish that there were bigger swings associated with it. That it feels like they just didn't. Within this film, I'm not talking about their cinematic universe. We could talk about that.
But, I'm saying I even disagree there. I think we are not talking about the fact we take for granted how much of a risk this movie was. I mean that sincerely. Okay. The company was not confident in this movie. In fact, they were so not confident in what a big swing this seemed like at the time that they attached the first Roger Rabbit short, Trouble, to it. And not only did they attach it, they put equal push behind Roger Rabbit. In fact, they sent out to like film critics and like writers, they sent out mini champagne bottles filled with unpopped popcorn. Let me check my notes here that said, start your new year off with a bang, and in equal size, the logos for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and Tummy Trouble, which, by the way, would be a cool piece of memorabilia to have.
If only somebody had that.
Not only did somebody buy it.
How is that possible?
Oh, my God.
If only somebody's significant other may have heard
Hey,
me.
Will, yeah. Are you? Hey, Will, are you on here? Can you get some screen grabs of these things? Because I would like us to be able.
I would love to be able to post some of these. I can take pictures. Great. Yeah. Now let me say it would only be, the only other thing is maybe someone's significant other said when that person who bought this said, "Wouldn't it be funny if I popped popcorn from 1989 that's in this bottle and I ate it while recording this episode?" And they said, "Please don't do that. You will get very sick. It's not worth it.
You'll get very sick." It's true.
She had to step in. Yeah, at some point.
I want to piggyback on what you're talking about on the Tummy Trouble thing for a second because there was a June 28th Los Angeles Times article talked about how Disney's decision to pair Tummy Trouble with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was a quote-unquote masterstroke and suggested the film benefited with that. Moviegoers who were unable to secure tickets to the sold-out releases of Batman, which came out the same weekend, the highest grossing release with the same opening weekend as Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. So the idea... I 100% agree with you that it was not a sign of confidence that they attached Roger Rabbit, the Roger Rabbit short to it, but it was also brilliant sense that it did generate what they wanted it to do. So,
and for anybody, just a little background, for anybody who hasn't seen the shorts, all three Roger Rabbit shorts that they produced are on Disney Plus to watch now. What they did is they produced three Roger Rabbit short cartoons that are, for the most part, in-universe cartoons that Roger Rabbit did with Baby Herman. It's kind of like after Cavalier and Clay was a hit, they made that comic book of the actual escapist comics.
Yes, the escapist.
Like the in-universe stuff. This is like that, which, you know, I know all the time people are comparing Roger Rabbit to Cavalier and Clay. I'm just one in a many, people making that comparison. But it is that thing. So what they did, and it was a bit of controversy because... it was supposed to be Spielberg was supposed to have some say over where these were attached because Spielberg has a lot of control over Roger Rabbit and Amblin does. And I believe the second film that they attached it to, which I do have it somewhere here, what it was, but there was contention because I think Spielberg wanted it attached. Spielberg wanted it attached to Arachnophobia, which was an Amblin co-production. But Eisner and I guess Katzenberg and Nolan were very concerned about Dick Tracy. So they went ahead and paired the second short, Roller Coaster Rabbit, with Dick Tracy. And then the third one they pair with A Far Off Place. So these were all attempts to like, hey, can we get people in the seats for these weird, stupid things we're doing?
Didn't really work for Dick Tracy or for Far Off Place, though, to the same degree.
But I I'm convinced amongst the many things.
You say
things,
Dick Tracy didn't do well?
Dick Tracy did fine.
Dick Tracy did pretty well.
Dick Tracy did not do well enough to justify the money. That was the thing. Katzenberg very famously said, we spent way too much to appease Beatty's ego. And that was kind of...
I think they also thought... I mean, they really thought they had Batman on their hands. $162 million at the box office on a $46 million budget before P&A, perhaps. I mean, that's not... But I mean, no one took a bath
on that.
They're
not factoring in. They're not factoring in just how much merchandise was produced for that movie.
I'm sure.
They planned on this being a franchise. They had so much merch. They were going to build a theme park ride, Dick Tracy's Crime Stoppers, which was going to be you riding around in a car using Tommy guns to shoot, like... Prune Face and all, you would have been just like wielding guns in a theme park.
That's awesome.
It's a shame.
Dick Tracy is a fucking great movie. Anyone who doesn't like Dick Tracy is, I mean,
listen,
tell me you don't like Dick Tracy.
Up until Black Panther, it won the most Oscars of any comic
book
movie.
He loves it.
Dick Tracy? I was a kid.
The man's dropping Prune Face. Listen, there's no way he doesn't like it.
But that's the thing. I was a kid. My dad is a huge comic book fan, and I was a kid, that whole rush of Dick Tracy, The Phantom, The Shadow. I fucking loved The Shadow as a kid and then tried to watch it again as an adult and went, oh, this all looks like a 30 Rock sketch. But at the time, I loved The Shadow. I loved all that. And I think that's kind of, to bring it back to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, I liked the movies, but I loved the show because the show was a lot more, as a kid, I stand by the show. I will defend the show to the end because the show takes that premise and goes with it. And I really like that.
When was the show produced? Because I really have no idea.
I had no idea.
I feel like I should.
So the show, let me see, I got my timeline here of everything. guys, we're going to get into this. It's nuts. Give me the whole timeline.
Wait, let's start from the first.
Of just Honey, or do you want the full cinematic universe? Because I can get into that now.
I can get into it later. We're going to do both. So give me the Honey timeline.
Okay.
The shrunk timeline, as I call it.
The shrunk line,
if you will. Yeah.
So we get Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in 1989. In 1990, in response to that, because you have to remember also, the 2 years you've chosen to cover on your podcast are two very significant years for the theme park industry, which Phil could not give a shit about. But they're significant.
But Kenny does, and that's, and you mean...
Deeply care about the theme park industry.
Is Kenny the guy I should have been pitching my, you should do a whole episode on Universal Islands of Adventure pitch to? Because, you know, that's there.
Yeah, that's Kenny's, so, that's Kenny's that bag
come,
right there.
When did that come out?
Universal Islands of Adventure opens in 99. Disney MGM Studios opens in 89. So both years have a significant park.
So I wonder if this is, just a tangent, I wonder if this is a somewhat... relatable experience for a Disney kid. I would go down to Orlando all the time. Mm-hmm. I would go down to Orlando almost every year with my family. Mm-hmm. And I would hit all of the Disney parks. I could only convince my parents to take one day away from the Disney property.
We did the exact same
thing. I have never been to Islands of Adventure because I love Universal so deeply that I couldn't ever dream of not going to Universal and taking a flyer in Islands of Adventure. So I don't know. It's crazy, but I've never been there.
I will say this, Kenny. I have a lot of nostalgia for the regular Universal. My significant other and I were just there the November before all this shit went down for her birthday, and we went to both parks. I have a lot of nostalgia for the regular Universal Studios, and when I tell you, I don't mean to offend you, but I will tell you, Islands of Adventure makes that look like a sack of shit. It's so well done. It's so...
I believe you.
Because it's so well done because after budget cuts made Eisner terminate a bunch of Imagineers who were working on Animal Kingdom, Universal poached them over to Islands of Adventure, and now there's these incredibly detailed sections devoted to mythological figures and comic strip characters and Jurassic Park. It's incredible. It's a wonderful place.
Quick synopsis for the people that haven't seen this film. when kids sneak into inventor Wayne Szalinski, played by Rick Moranis' upstairs lab, to retrieve an Arab baseball, his experimental shrink ray miniaturizes them. When Szalinski returns home, he destroys the device, which he thinks is a failure, and dumps it in the trash, throwing out the kids along with it. The four children, now a quarter inch tall, must survive the journey back to the house through a yard where sprinklers bring treacherous storms and a garden variety ant stampede like elephants. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids opened on June 23rd, 1989, in second place behind Batman, but ahead of Ghostbusters 2, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and Dead Poets Society. It would go on to make $222 million worldwide on an $18 million budget. It's got 77% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and only 54% from audiences.
What? Roger,
which I think is kind of crazy. With a $222 million worldwide box office, you'd think audiences like this thing, but
I thought audience liked this thing.
Yeah. Roger Ebert gave the film 2 stars and said, "I've been trying to figure out exactly what's missing in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. The special effects are all there nicely in place and the production values are sound, but the movie is dead in the water. It tells an amazing and preposterous story and it seems bored by it. It uses the same sorts of visual effects we remember from The Incredible Shrinking Man, but it lacks the same sense of fun. The closing scenes are an example of how low energy the film is. One of the kids is about to accidentally be devoured in a spoonful of Cheerios. The scene should have been milked, Jesus Christ, for suspense and malicious
glee. I like that. That's good.
Instead, it unfolds with lead-footed predictability, and James Horner's music here and elsewhere in the film is no help. It sounds surprisingly familiar and seems to be a retread of the Nino Rota score for Fellini's Amacord. Mm-hmm. In the Fellini movie, it worked. Okay. Couple things. First of all, we talked a little bit earlier about how Disney was a little bit gun shy in this film and that maybe they didn't think it was going to do that well, and thus they tacked on the Roger Rabbit short to the top of it. But if you're concerned about this film not doing well, don't open it on the same weekend as Batman, which I think is actually a sign that they were quite confident about this movie.
I don't know. I wasn't alive then, so I have no idea how much hype there was for Batman.
You know, you have to rub it in that you're a child. That's fine. We get it. You're younger than us.
Yeah. There was more hype for Batman than any other film ever made.
Okay.
But here's what I'll say. Yes. First off, if anybody listened to my Pokemon episode, they know my feelings on Roger Ebert, so I won't get too into his particular stances on things. I will also say, just as a sidebar, I now know why on the Pokemon episode I sound like I just did a line of blow in the Studio 54 bathroom. It's because once you say, when we started Pokemon, you went, "I got 2 hours. Is that enough time for you?" I'm like, "Oh, right. I got to rattle these off like the Micro Machines guy." Because I have pages of notes and I'm determined to get them all in.
Micro Machines. That's a great callback.
Here's what I'll say to that particular sense. I watched this time for the rewatch and I actually loved how low key it was, because my thing is I kept sitting back and going, this was number two at the box office. This was a hit that is predominantly Rick Moranis in his yard, kids with big practical effects. Nobody is destroying the world. There's no massive stakes. The big conflict is, hey, maybe you should get along better with your neighbor's parents and siblings. And hey, tell your dad you don't want to play sports. Especially because I love those 60s Disney films. I love those kind of low-key programmers that they have. I looked at this and I was so envious of that, because I was like, right, this could come out and it would not be Think Piece to Death or Compared to a Million and One Things, and audiences would show up for it. And maybe part of it is that, yes, Roger Ebert called out that he uses Amarcord. He also used the jazz song Powerhouse, which Disney had to pay a settlement for to release the soundtrack, because he just blatantly stole another song in the score.
It also sounds a lot like the Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Especially during the Breakfast Machine, 100%.
Yeah.
But that all said, like, you know, maybe it's because if it came out now, we would have 50 million pieces about how it stole the score. And then all we would know about the movie is it stole the score.
Yeah.
And nobody would go see it as a result, because this is what we do to movies. And I look at this and I'm like, right, this is such a pure little thing. And the fact that this was able to be number two, I'm myself, you could call it nostalgia, I guess, because I'm saying, oh, I wish we could do this again. But it was more just the sense of, I looked at this and went, right, this is the kind of movie that you wouldn't make now. You would not make something so lo-fi from a major studio and go, yeah, I hope families show up for this. This is a nice base hit for us.
Well, the irony of what you're saying is that we're getting a Disney Plus sequel now, directed by on streaming. But I'm just directed by Joe Johnson. That is going to be co-written and starring Josh Gad. I only say it because it shows that the only way you could do a concept like this today is to use the original IP as a cover.
Well, because, I mean, and I've talked about this before, like we talked about Nutcracker and the Four Realms, we talked about that. Disney does make these swings from time to time.
Yeah.
And they're one of the few studios besides like your occasional Mortal Engines or something like that. Like Disney makes these swings from time to time. And I always get so fucking mad when people go, we don't get original ideas anymore. And I'm like, we do. Oh, you don't go see them. Yeah, you just don't go.
It's terrible. Yeah. People, forget even not seeing them. People treat them terribly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like, that's the thing that drives me so nuts. I understand if Immortal Engines doesn't play, but, oh, people shit on new ideas before the trailer is finished. Yeah. But that's... I hear everything you say, Mike. I agree with everything you say. I don't think it changes the fact that ultimately I don't think this is a fantastic movie, but I do have nostalgia for this period as well. I don't necessarily agree that if an original idea...
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Could break through. I still think that an idea like this would be the idea that would break through, which is this is high concept enough that I think, and maybe you wind up on a streamer with it, but I got to tell you, that's the whole thing now. I have the screenplay out right now that's only going to screeners. Certainly wasn't intended that way. But that's just how you sell movies. So I think for this moment, we might be maybe in a place where original ideas have a chance to get made. Now, do they have a chance to crack the cultural conversation?
Yeah.
It's a much different question.
Yeah, totally.
But
I think that, you know, I agree with what you're both saying. And I think that, Mike, I had a similar feeling that you had watching this last night, just thinking how, and I hate this word, but like how quaint this movie feels to a certain degree or another. And I also agree with what, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, Kenny, but like the script is the script sucks. Like the script is just, it's thin and they just don't do the work. Weirdly, there's four people that worked on this script and yet the script feels like it's surface and it could have got deeper into it and it could have been a great film. And instead, I think it's a good film with its heart in the right place in terms of the filmmaking of it, but ultimately, no, thin when it comes to anything else. I do want to just sort of talk about a couple of the set pieces. There's not, I mean, as we have just said, I want to talk about just a little bit of some casting stuff. Chevy Chase, John Candy both turned down the role that ultimately went to Rick Moranis, as did Martin Short. For the scene in which miniaturized Nick Selinsky drops into a bowl of Cheerios cereal, its ink was filled with 16,000 gallons of milk-like substance made from chlorinated water, food thickener, and pigment. And the Cheerios are made out from tractor inner tubes, 12 feet in diameter, coated in
film. I want to talk about Moranis for a second.
Please. Yeah.
I believe this is the first time you and I have been able to discuss Moranis.
This is. We'll get to talk about him again for Parenthood, but yes, this is the first time. Yeah.
And obviously, Moranis kind of stopped making films by '99, and he's kind of creeping back in a little bit. I know
his wife passed away, and he wanted to take care of his children and focus on
being a parent, and that's his want, and obviously that's valid.
Yeah, sure.
Rick Moranis is one of the few stars that made a very specific kind of family-friendly film. If it was a Rick Moranis film, you kind of knew what you were getting.
Totally.
That's why, you know, John Candy and Chevy Chase and Martin Short, if they make this movie, they're just movies.
Yep.
Right? Which is fine. They make great movies sometimes. But this is a Rick Moranis movie, which was its own animal and which I think meant something to parents. Even Ghostbusters, I think it meant something to parents. He had a veneer of safety and fun that you don't really see a lot. I suppose Josh Gad is trying to do the same thing. It's very hard to do in today's landscape.
For sure.
You know, but yeah, I really, really love Moranis. I love that there's a bit of a Moranissance when it comes to, you know, popular opinion about him and critical opinion about him. I think he is a different version of male masculinity that we don't get anymore.
I was just going to say, it's wonderful that there was a time when a Rick Moranis could be above the title. Do you know what I mean?
And where a dad, you could, right? Yeah, like, yeah, you know, yeah. Chevy is your dad. Like Chevy, yeah. Like that's dad. But like Rick Moranis is also another kind of dad. Yeah. And obviously he gets picked on a lot, but like, you didn't see a lot of Moranis movies where he wasn't domestic, where he didn't have kids, where he wasn't.
I mean, Little Shop, but that's the outlier.
Actually,
I guess.
That was 80s. You want an outlier, Phil? I will tell you guys one thing about Moranis and why I'm sad he retired. Kenny is absolutely right. This is how we picture Moranis. This is the kind of movie he made. I think he branched out maybe once in his career in a forgotten musical by Walter Hill named Streets of Fire. That my co-host and I are obsessed with.
I know Streets of Fire.
Right. And Rick Moranis. Rick Moranis is not playing a nerd, a dad,
that was
anything.
Early, though, right?
Yeah, it's like, but he's playing this Weasley, smooth talking prick. And when I watch Streets of Fire, I just keep thinking, like, right, I'm not just sad he retired because childhood nostalgia, oh, I want Rick Moranis' dad, but I look at him, I'm like, yeah, he could be a lot more than what he got asked to play. And I think in this movie, as opposed to the sequels, what I like about him in this movie is that I remember him playing a much more zany, wacky scientist nerd dad. And in the sequels, he is. He's a lot more. He's a lot more. Wah! And so when Nick runs up and he's like, "Dad, I want to show you this thing," I was expecting him to turn around and go, "No, son, I have to recalibrate the plan." And instead.
A real riff on Doc Brown, but he's not.
Instead, he is a dad. He looks at his kid. He goes, "Yeah, look, can you just go to your mom? I'm busy right now." And he's talking like he's doing paperwork or doing a deposition or doing something instead of tinkering with a shrink ray. And I think that's something I really liked about this movie, too, is that instead of being Fred McMurray in The Absent-Minded Professor or Merlin Jones or any of the other ones, he is like, it was kind of written like, what if we did a straight up regular family movie?
Well, it's
where I you know,
I totally agree. And I would actually say that, you know, in 89, as I mentioned, he's in Parenthood as well. And there's a line between those two types of parents. The one that he plays in this and the one he plays in that. And obviously, Parenthood's a much more grounded film. But he's also a dad in that who doesn't really know how to connect with his kids, or with his child, that is. He's having a struggle. His marriage is on the rocks, which is similarly in this film, at least for the first third
kind
of it or
of,
so. Little bit. They're not communicating well. Let's just put it that way. Yeah. And I think that there's, to your point, like there's something very sort of very grounded and human about his performance in this film that I certainly didn't clock as a kid and wasn't expecting.
The wife is insanely understanding. In my opinion. I remember. I mean, in the middle of it, I asked my kids what would happen if I shrunk you, and they said mom would kill you, which is what she would do, and she wouldn't be wrong. But the whole movie, I don't know who the actress who plays his wife. The whole movie, she continues to kind of.
Yeah.
Protect his ego a little
bit. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're a great guy. You're really smart. You're going to work this out.
Yep.
There isn't, like, not that I care. Like, that's the supportive marriage. She didn't do it on purpose. I'm totally down with that. But yeah, she is wildly supportive of him.
Well, but I think that comes with the territory that she's married to an inventor. I mean, let's face it, some of the things that probably fly in in your house, like, you know, I imagine I grew up with a lawyer.
Hey, go ahead, speculate.
No, but I'm saying, like, I grew up, my dad was a lawyer. And if one day I came home and I said, hey, Mom, why has Dad locked himself away in a room for 3 hours? And she went, he's trying to figure out what this one bank robber should say. She wouldn't be cool with that because she's like, you're a lawyer. Why are you getting so worked up at that? But your job as a writer, your job is these things. And there's pitfalls right. that come with that. If you understand that you're married to a guy that, you know, it's the same way. Like, you know, if your dad was a mechanic and the way and his wife came home and said, why are the kids covered in oil? There's a more logical explanation than if sure. he's a banker sure, and the sure, kids sure. are covered in oil. Sure. I'd be more pissed sure. then. I will say also on the one thing about the show. I will do more show talk on my own. I don't care.
Oh, there's going to be so much show talk, guys. Don't worry.
Two pages. But one thing I'll say about the show. The only time the Zelinskys have marital issues of any kind is the first third of this movie. When they move to the show, which takes place in between Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and Honey, I Blew Up the Kids, even though it's...
In the timeline. In the shrunk
yeah,
line.
Yeah, because the baby isn't born yet. I will say this about the show. The Wayne and Diane... Every episode, insanely hot for each other. They have the really? Happiest marriage. This is one of the horniest
I like
shows.
That. That's nice.
Look,
that's
this nice. Is this show is horned up to hell. The first thing I watched, I messaged Phil directly months ago and said the fourth episode of this show is about how the daughter has such a crush on her teacher that she travels back in time to the 70s when he was a teenager exclusively to hook up with him. The show is batshit with horniness. it happens... constantly. There's so many jokes like that. And
oh
like
my God.
But what's amazing is in the show, all of the horniness yeah. and friskiness feels right and you ride with it and it's part of the humor.
Sure, sure.
In this movie, I actually liked this movie. I enjoyed the ride. I had a really good time. They get to the end, they're having breakfast all together as a big group, or they're having dinner with the giant turkey. And I'm like, this was fun. This yep. was really cute.
That's lovely.
Right?
I love that.
Then it starts to fade out, zooms back up, and the kid goes, I get it. French class. And my notes say, fuck you. I hate this.
Yeah, the
I
fucking,
hate
the,
that.
I hated the fourth wall break I at the end there it. Where he talks right to the camera for a shitty joke.
Right?
I hated it too. I
it's
hated
so
it.
Gross.
Oh, wait. Kenny liked it.
Why
Kenny liked
did you
it.
Hate it?
Why did I hate it? Because it doesn't. Okay. Here's what
it's
I'll
not
do.
Funny, it's dumb, and
you don't have kids. This is a kids' movie,
but
and
sure.
this is directed at kids of a certain age.
Okay,
it's the exact kind of kids who may or may not get that joke. So my two kids, both 8 years old, a twin, Layla got it, the girl, and Rollins didn't. So me and Layla were like kind of looking at each other like, this idiot doesn't get it. Like, this is a funny joke. Layla's like, this is hilarious. And to have that come back at the end was kind of a great little family moment. So you guys are wrong. And fuck you. I hate it.
Here's what I'll say. Here's my thing. Here's where I get – and this is my problem with 80s comedies and 80s family films in general. Because again, 1990, like I don't have any emotional attachment to these things. Here's my thing. And this is where I get tripped up. 80s movies do this weird thing where sexual humor and sexual references just randomly show up when you're not prepared for them. And like 90s family films from the get-go either go, hey, we've got some teens in this and they're horny as shit. Or they go, we've got some teens in this and we're never going to talk about what they're interested in. But 80s movies... If you watch The Goonies and you're like, this is fun to watch with kids, and then at one point, early on, Corey Feldman just goes, this is where we keep the sex slaves. You go, what the fuck is this? Why are you saying that
here? That would be
here?
Weird. That'd be weird.
Yeah,
that'd
okay.
be
weird. He does. That's in the movie. Here's another one, and this is touchy because I know Phil loves this movie. I remember being at my grandma's house when I was like 6, putting in the VHS of E.T., watching it and being like, this is fine, it's E.T., and the kid yells, penis breath, and I hit the remote.
Shut up, penis breath.
I hit the remote. I was like, can we be watching this? My grandma's here. That's not appropriate to say in front of her. I got real strung out as a kid, because I was just like, what is this? It's these weird intrusions of things that, like, so with this, with the French class joke, if this movie was a little more on board with, like, hey, they're teens, and you know how teens
it's
are.
It's still a pretty horny movie. They do make out in the Lego
they
piece.
Do.
I love their make out. I don't know why what it is about it, but
it's
like
weird.
It's sweet.
It's sweet, but it's weird.
I love Little Russ. I love Little Russ. Little
Russ
Jr. Well, they call him Little Russ.
Yeah,
but I like his plight. I like that, you know, he's just a little guy. As a guy who's 8 inches shorter than my father, I could really relate to it.
So there's one thing that I think is not one thing, but there's in an early version of the script, there were five kids and one of them dies
That's insane.
Sprinkler sequence, which I think is absolutely insane. Yeah. I love it. I wish we got that movie because that movie is a very different movie.
You don't love that. That becomes Battle Royale. Like you don't like you kill it. You kill a kid and you and it's a different movie. Now there's a movie. It's called Battle Royale, and you could totally watch kids.
I don't know that. I don't remember Battle Royale shrinking kids to the size.
No,
of,
you know what it is. It's The Incredible Shrinking Man. The Incredible Shrinking Man is
they,
a movie.
They kill a kid.
No, but The Incredible Shrinking Man is
but
that
there's
thing.
Like real violence in it,
and it starts out being like, "Oh, isn't this fun? He's small," and it ends with him going, "I understand. Even if I shrink into oblivion, I am not forsaken because God knows me." And you're like, "Oh, this is really heavy for a movie I thought was just a guy fights a cat with a needle."
I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand why a kid didn't die in this film. It's a very different film if he does. I'm just, I guess my point is that that's kind of crazy and, you know, that could have been
funny.
You know
what's interesting is we're not talking about the movie that is most
reminiscent
that owes this movie.
Sure.
What?
Most reminiscent of,
No, no, this movie that owes this movie the biggest debt, and that's the Alexander Payne film, Downsizing.
Downsizing.
The worst film ever made.
I was going I thought you were going a different direction, but okay. I thought you were going a different film.
I love that we talked about Downsizing on the Three
on the
Kings
last
episode
one.
Two.
I know what I would do with Downsizing because now you guys are getting me rolling. What the end of Downsizing?
Yeah,
Downsizing sucked so badly. It was the worst.
Yeah.
But the real existential threat for the people who are downsized is that somehow it's like. I mean, another movie I hate, The Departed, but we're like, the files go missing. And all the people who are responsible for the little village no longer know why this little village is there. And now these little people have to make do in the real world. That seems like the thing where you could start squashing people with, you know, normal people can squash them like ants by accident. And then you get some real social commentary about what we do to the little people in the world as opposed to finding transcendence or whatever the fuck they did in the cave. Sorry, go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right. I have real problems.
I could have been a much better Kings, movie. And I think I just saved Downsizing.
Yeah, he really did. So I just want to talk. we just kind of jump through the plot a little bit here, but I want to talk about the credit sequence, which reminded me a little of Catch Me If You Can.
I can tell you about that credit sequence. I got.
Please tell us all about the credit sequence.
So I actually love that.
Christmas Vacation.
Well, that's the thing. I love that credit sequence. If you listen to our podcast, if anybody wants to listen to You're Missing Out, on our Modern Times episode, I picked a film for the registry, which is called Technological Threat by Bill and Susan Croyer. Technological Threat is a great animated short by Bill and Susan Croyer where it was half hand-drawn and half computer animation. It's one of the early integrations of hand-drawn and computer animation. And the short was kind of a joke about this hand-drawn cartoon wolf who looks very Chuck Jonesy, Tex Avery, getting systematically replaced by robots that are all done with computer animation. And it was a comment on how the animation industry was on the verge of the hand-drawn animation industry was on the verge of being wiped out by computer animation. It was nominated for an Oscar and lost to Pixar's Tin Toy, which is real on the nose. But people were so impressed with this short that they were hired to do the animation opening sequences for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Christmas Vacation, and Troop Beverly Hills. But what
I love the beginning of Troop Beverly Hills too.
And what's super interesting to me about this is that one of the animators who worked on this opening sequence for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids is Andrew Stanton, who would later go on to do all those films for Pixar.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I love an animated credit sequence. We don't do it enough. I honestly think the last one I can think of is Catch Me If You Can. And that was kind of a crazy outlier at the time. Like I remember being like, huh, I haven't seen something like this in a really long time. It's great. We meet the family, we meet the kids, we meet everybody. We also meet the neighbors, the father played by Max Frewer, of Max Headroom fame, fellow Canadian with, Rick Moranis and myself. But I think that he has a very Jim Carrey style that I never really thought about until at one point I walked out of the room for a second and just hearing his voice, I was like, it's so much like Jim Carrey. I don't know if you guys tapped into that or felt that.
I felt that a little bit, but as I was telling you off mic, as a kid, I remember this role being Jim Varney, and it's not. And I don't know if it's that he's wearing the fishing cap. I don't know if it's at the same time there was some Ernest Disney stuff going on, like Ernest Rides Splash Mountain, and I just conflated it.
Sure, sure, sure.
But I specifically remembered this being a role played by Jim Varney until this rewatch when I found that it wasn't. But I vividly remember in my kid brain that it's Jim Varney.
I think this was a pretty well-written part, to be honest. I think that the secret of this is the way his wife treats him. The way they joke with each other, the way, even though he's almost cartoonish, she loves him, and therefore there's something valid totally. In him. And I always remember him being kind of menacing, but he really isn't. He really isn't. And he has a nice little moment that kind of is a window into his humanity when he sees Russ pining for, what's the girl's name?
Amy Zielinski. Yeah.
And you could see his heart kind of break. Mm-hmm. And that's a dad who gives a shit. Mm-hmm. So that's a dad who could have handled his son not playing sports, I think. And it was more, on Russ. But I think that was really, really important that they humanized that character. They kind of hit that tone perfectly.
I totally agree. It's funny. When this film started, and I don't know why, but I always thought it was a Touchstone movie. I know it's a Disney film. But
yeah.
So for whatever reason, my brain kind of associates them a little bit. And in 89, there's a big run of Touchstone films in 89. Obviously, this harkens back to what you were saying earlier about the Eisner, Katzenberg, really trying to kind of weaponize Touchstone Pictures as its own thing and branding things more sort of specifically. But it's just interesting to sort of I think about sort of Adventures in Babysitting and those Touchstone films kind of are in the same ilk with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And maybe that's a false association, but I kind of do that.
No, I get that. I was surprised too when I saw that. Yeah.
Well, because Roger Rabbit's Touchstone, it's not Disney for whatever reason.
Yeah. This is a kid's film.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, for sure, for sure.
And it's a kid's film made for kids, and any parent who enjoys it kind of probably enjoys it on the level we're enjoying it. Acknowledging that this is made for babies.
For sure.
But Adventures of Babysitting is not really a kid's film. Adventures of Babysitting is a teen film.
Yeah.
You know, it really is made for more mature audiences. And there wasn't really a place for that to live at the time. Touchstone is the place where movies like that lived. But this as a Touchstone film, there's a little more edge to those. And I think there would have to be a little more edge to this.
I totally agree.
Yep. It's a little too high concept, I think, to be a Touchstone film.
I also, so in terms of like the plot, because there isn't really much of one, there are just sequences that I think are worth kind of pointing out. And they're really kind of these kind of tentpole moments that they thought of, I'm assuming, on a screenwriting level as to sort of how, what are the various things that could be a threat to these kids if they're very small. So you have the B sequence, which is fucking great, where Nick falls into the pollen and he's kind of taken off with a bee, which again, like, listen, some of the effects obviously don't hold up as well as others, but there's some stuff that looks really, really great. Like, you know, they threw that kid into a giant dandelion or whatever it was.
Everything practical looks
the,
amazing.
The ant scorpion fight. Every, Harryhausen shit. Yeah. And rules.
It's great.
Even
the giant rain stuff. I mean, my brain went to Chubby Rain from Bowfinger, but still, like, I think that there's something great about just what, I don't know, like, what's a threat to something that's a quarter inch tall. It's I don't know. It's not rocket science what they're doing, but it works. You mentioned the ant stuff. Ron tames this ant and calls it Anty. The cigarette butt from the father, which is a great practical thing too. Like, it looks, the way that cigarette butt looks fantastic.
I also, on that stop motion fight, I want to make sure we single out, it's Phil Tippett.
Please.
Phil Tippett did the stop motion work. The same person that did Star Wars, Jurassic Park, RoboCop. Mm-hmm.
Jurassic Park.
That's why that's some real high qualities. I think the only
It looks great.
It looks great.
The only
it looks
effect,
great. It's very cool.
The only effect that has aged like absolute shit, I think, is there is the when Matt Frewer is being enlarged, looks god awful. At the end.
Yeah, it looks terrible.
Everything else I can at least write off as like, it was the time, it was this, it was that. That's the one that I went, oh, this is bad.
There's just, the biggest issue they ultimately have is the separation issue, right? Where it's like screen and, you know, it's the flying stuff or whenever there's sort of a background, a blue screen or whatever the screen is that they've got behind it. But
But ultimately, you know, the as you mentioned, the ant scorpion fight is great. Auntie dies, which is, I'm assuming, the substitution for the death of a child that originally
and works better. It works better.
Yeah. Also horrifying.
Yeah,
horrifying.
Super sad. Yeah.
My daughter immediately went over to our dog and just started hugging her. Like that's affecting.
Yeah.
I can't believe they killed the ant. To be honest, like I don't think they should have. I'm being very serious here. I don't think they should have. I don't think this movie needed it, and I think that what they did was so heroic and so brave. They deserve the win.
So hold on. In your version of it, the ant is only injured, I'm assuming, and the ant becomes the pet of Ron?
No, the ant goes back to its family, but like the ant survives. They have an E.T. Elliot goodbye. Like just think that I really do think that, you know, it's another one of my issues with Departed is that Leo won that movie and you took it away for no reason.
All right.
They had the
I love that you just called The Departed into the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids episode.
They had the guts, the kids, to stare down this giant scorpion.
It's true.
To have the ant die? What lesson is that? All right, go ahead.
I'm just going to say, if Kenny is going to bring it into The Departed thing again at some point, we go, you got to let me get into the shared universe thing. I have to. I promise the people.
We will. Just let me just hit please. two other
go
things
right ahead.
Really quick.
I'm just saying. Okay. You know.
Let me get just
the last 10 minutes of this podcast are yours. I want to hear it all.
Yeah. Quickly, the lawnmower sequence I thought looked pretty great as well. Loved the whole like them being sort of sucked up through the whole earthworm burrow thing, whatever. Yeah, I thought that was cool. We talked a little bit about the Cheerios thing, which is really kind of, I think that's the apex of the movie in terms of just...
And it's an iconic show.
It's iconic. It's great. The kid screaming, "Dad, don't eat me," as he's being pulled up into his mouth. It's just great. It's a great visual gag. I also will say, too, that I found that it's not to say that the stuff in the lawn didn't look great, because it did. But weirdly, I found the stuff in the house to be that much more engaging, because it just felt so much more terrestrial to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Like when you see the nails or the wood floors and all that stuff being built and imagining what it must have been like to be on that set where they just built everything to be the giant spoon, like all that kind of stuff just must have been so much fun to shoot.
I think you're hitting on what I felt like I was missing. Mm-hmm. The fact that most of this film took place in one terrain, I think was the mistake. I think backyards can have a lot of different terrains if you want them to. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was kind of just one jungle they were going through for most of this movie. That being said, I'm softening a lot on my criticisms of this film. Like it really is fun. It really is bringing a lot back. I think my son affected me too much.
Yeah, it feels like Rollins just really came down hard on this movie.
So all he really wanted to do was watch Fortnite videos. So, you know.
Well,
you can't watch Fortnite videos? I can watch a sucky movie?
Okay.
To get him in here.
So, first of all, we do need to have an episode where Rollins comes on to do... Like I'm all for it. I don't know if you are, Kenny.
Oh, he's all for it, for sure.
So... We're going to let you off the chain now.
Okay.
Okay. So, Mike, you just go to town. It should also be said, I know, Kenny, that you have a hard out. So, if you need to go, I'll stick around with Mike for a bit and
I
he can
hear
do
what
his.
We got. Let's do this.
Let's go.
The TV show stuff, I'm just going to record separately, use what you want, but we're going to get into the shared universe here.
Okay.
Before we give Mike the stage. Yes. Mike the mic.
Yeah.
Should we do a quick rating?
Yeah, just quickly.
Yeah.
In 89, I would have given it probably an 85. I liked it as a kid a lot. Last night, I probably would have given it a 65. And now after this conversation, I might be at a 70. That's kind of where I'm at.
Oh, shit, Phil. You're harsher than I am. Okay. 87 before as a child, 75 yesterday. Mm-hmm. I really do like the movie. I think every movie in 89 is better than most movies in 99.
Great.
And I'm not gonna go that higher, but I'll go up to 78. Like I do think this is like a worthwhile film.
All right. Mike, what about you?
I would say it probably would have been about an 85 when I was a kid, because I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was coming into this ready to give it an 80, and I feel like somehow you guys have taken it down to a 75 for me. So you have actually unlike Pokemon, you have worn me down a little bit.
I'm the highest of the group. I love it the most. All right, Mike, what is going on in the shrunken verse?
All right, so for anybody, any of your listeners who are not familiar with the concept of the Tommy Westfall theory, this was developed by Dwayne McDuffie, a comic book writer, to point out the absurdity of using guest appearances in other shows to connect things. But people have taken it way too seriously now, which tends to happen when comic writers come up with goofy theories. But it needs to be said, there are a couple things that connect Honey, I Shrunk the Kids to other things. Some of it is within the films itself. For example, Citizen Kane and Raiders of the Lost Ark technically take place in the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids universe, because in Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, they go to a warehouse where they walk past a crate that is holding the Rosebud sled and another crate that specifically says on it, the Ark of the Covenant is seen in the lab security warehouse in Honey, I Blew Up the Kid with a box having the same numerical code and everything, 9906753, except now also labeled Ark of the Covenant. So those two are just because of that movie. But where it all becomes a lot bigger is you have to go to the theme parks. So after Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, they created a second theme park attraction in Epcot called Honey, I Shrunk the Audience. Now, Honey, I Shrunk the Audience takes place at the Imagination Institute. It was put into a theater as a 3D show to replace Captain EO because, well, you know. So they did that.
Have you done this ride? Have either of you been to Honey, I Shrunk the Audience?
It's been gone for like almost a decade now, but I did ride it once upon a time. Now, this takes place at the Imagination Institute, where they are awarding Inventor of the Year to Wayne Szalinski. This award is being presented by the head of the Imagination Institute, who we all know is, let's say it together, Dr. Nigel Channing, played by Eric Idle. Okay, so we're in the Imagination Institute. That's where this thing takes place. It is pre-Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves. It's post-Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, because the little kid is involved. But that ride doesn't really matter as much as we get to the millennium, 1999. Michael Eisner wants to redo a bunch of the rides in Epcot in honor of the millennium celebration. So they decide to take a beloved attraction called Journey into Imagination that was originally hosted by a guy named the Dreamfinder and a little dragon named Figment, and it taught you the magic of imagination. It had a song by the Sherman Brothers, and it was wonderful. And they decide to overhaul it completely and call it Journey into Your Imagination, which is now hosted by, that's right, Dr. Nigel Channing. Okay, we're all on board here. Dr. Nigel Channing now hosts the ride. And this is the Imagination Institute. Now, people fucking hate this version of the ride because it takes all the magic and wonder out of it, but it does set all of the Imagination Pavilion in Epcot now in the Imagination Institute. When they decide, after 2 years, this ride is so unpopular, they decide to revamp it. It's now called Journey into Imagination with Figment. They enhance the queue, and part of the queue is showing you all the other people who work at the Imagination Institute. Now, the other people who work at the Imagination Institute include, as you can imagine, Wayne Szalinski, right? But along with it, two different Professor Brainerds. Both Robin Williams' Professor Brainerd in Flubber is depicted on a wall in a picture holding his Flubber, and also many references to the original Professor Brainerd, the absent-minded professor, Fred McMurray. Right. On top of that, when you walk past an office, you see a jacket for Medfield College. Now, we all remember that Medfield College is, of course, the setting for both the Dexter Riley film starring Kurt Russell and the Merlin Jones films that we all remember so well, The Misadventures of Merlin Jones and Monkey's Uncle. We all know this. And let's not forget, Medfield also technically the setting for the Shaggy Dog, because it's the setting for the Shaggy DA. So we've now already established that Honey, I Shrunk the Kids exists in the same universe as the Merlin Jones films, The Absent-Minded Professor, the Shaggy DA, and Dexter Riley. But that's not all, because we also need to address the fact that on top of all of that, in the second Absent-Minded Professor movie, Son of Flubber, we get an appearance from a tax assessor. That tax assessor is playing the same character. Bob Sweeney is playing the same character of the tax assessor that he played in the George Burns and Gracie Allen show. So the George Burns and Gracie Allen show, of course, also takes place in the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids cinematic universe. We're all following this, right?
Wait, what?
Yeah. No. This is true.
George Burns and Gracie Allen show, I assume, is sketch comedy.
No, it's sitcom.
Go ahead. You're right.
Okay.
I mean, you're right. I believe you. Go ahead.
Okay. So let's get into this. Now, on top of that, we do have an interesting thing in here, which is, let me just find this little hiccup here. Okay. So in the Absent-Minded Professor movies, we get a character played by Keenan Wynn, who's named Alonzo Hawk. Now, Alonzo Hawk also appears in the motion picture Herbie Rides Again, which means that the entirety of the Herbie films are all also by virtue of being connected to the Absent-Minded Professor films that through the Imagination Institute in Epcot.
Wait, does that mean the Lindsay Lohan movies are also in
correct, Phil, correct. And it's just one film. But yes, you are absolutely correct. So those are all connected to the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids universe.
I mean, that tracks. That makes sense, obviously.
So to give you guys the full rundown of everything that exists, I have it written out here, everything that exists in chronological order in the Honey, I Shrunk-a-verse, we have 1941 Citizen Kane by virtue of Rosebud showing up. The George and Burns Gracie Allen show by virtue of the tax assessor showing up in the Absent-Minded Professor. Okay. 1959, The Shaggy Dog by virtue of the Shaggy DA, of course. 1961, The Absent-Minded Professor, Professor Brainerd's in the Imagination Institute. 1963, Son of Flubber by virtue of being a sequel to The Absent-Minded Professor. 1964, The Misadventures of Merlin Jones because Merlin Jones' name is said over loudspeaker in the Imagination Institute. 1965, The Monk's Uncle by virtue of Merlin Jones. 1968, The Love Bug by virtue of Herbie Rides Again. 1969, The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes because of the Medfield Jacket college jacket in the Imagination Institute, as well as a sign that says no tennis shoes to be worn. Also, fun fact, in the 1998 film Soldier, it is listed that Kurt Russell's character wins the Dexter Riley Award, which is named after his character Dexter Riley from the computer wore tennis shoes. 1972, Now You See Him, Now You Don't, Medfield College Jacket. 1974, Herbie Rides Again because of Keenan wins Alonzo Hawk. 1975, The Strongest Man in the World from the Medfield College Jacket, Shaggy DA from the Medfield College Jacket. 1977, Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo. 1980, Herbie Goes Bananas. 1981, Raiders of the Lost Ark because of the Ark of the Covenant, Honey, I Blew Up the Kids. 1982, Herbie the Love Bug TV series. 1982, Knight Rider TV show because in Herbie Fully Loaded, which is the Lindsay Lohan one, it mentions that Herbie used to hang out with Knight Rider. So yeah. Knight Rider is in there as well.
Right.
So, 1984, Indiana Jones Temple of Doom for the Raiders of the Lost Ark. 1987, The Magical World of Disney, The Return of the Shaggy Dog, again by virtue of the Shaggy Dog. 1989, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. 1989, also Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade by virtue of the Raiders of the Lost Ark connection. 1990, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movie set adventure. 1992, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. 1992, Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, obviously. 1994, Honey, I Shrunk the Audience, replacing Captain EO. 1997, Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves, which is the sole directorial credit of Dean Cundey, cinematographer on Back to the Future, Roger Rabbit, a number of John Carpenter films, also released direct-to-video, and the last Rick Moranis live-action role until that Mint Mobile commercial. 1997, Flubber, also connected, obviously. 1997 to 2000, that is, of course, my beloved Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV show. 1997, Herbie the Love Bug, the remake, starring Bruce Campbell. 1999, Journey into Your Imagination. 2002, Journey into Imagination with Figment. 2005, Herbie Fully Loaded by virtue of Herbie Rides Again. And the most recent film in the Shrunkiverse as of now, 2008's Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, again by virtue of the Ark of the Covenant. Until, of course, we get shrunk.
That was
unbelievable.
Psychotic.
That was...
I am so happy I was here for that. God, I hope that fucking goes viral.
Listen, hey, Josh, if you're listening, no one has hired me for anything. I'll do whatever you want on Shrunk, Josh, if you're listening.
Well, that was absolutely unbelievable. I know that, you know, the real fans are going to listen to the subsequent, can only assume will be 90 minutes to 2 hours of you talking about the television show, which we...
There's three pages, and I might add more. Yeah.
Which will be tacked on to the end of this episode. So we will... Kenny's leaving us.
I'm going to leave.
Okay.
Great to see you as always, Mike. Great to see you as always, everybody. Fans. Patrons. Bye.
Patrons. I will speak for Kenny when I say that we are unbelievably thankful for you coming on this episode to talk about this movie. We can't wait. Truly can't wait to have you back on the 99, to have you back on the regular feed. We'll find some shitty movie that you'll be willing to do far too much research on. Now we have let's call it an addendum, an extended deep dive that our guest Mike Natale was kind enough to do for us. We mentioned it obviously in the episode as well, but he went to the mat for this movie, and I would expect nothing less of him. But here is his individual efforts to kind of unpack Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Hi, everybody. This is Mike Natale. You know me from the Pokemon episode of Podcast Like It's 1999. Maybe you know me from my own podcast, You're Missing Out, where we're going through the films of the National Film Registry, though, judging by the numbers, that's probably a smaller circle that know me from that. But most likely you know me from the Patreon episode of Podcast Like It's 1989 about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which you just finished listening to. I probably should have led with that, looking back. But anyway, I'm here. We had some issues and some timing things going on during the podcast, which meant we couldn't get to some things. So Phil graciously offered me some time at the end of the podcast to talk about the larger world of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, particularly the 3-season-long Honey, I Shrunk the Kids television show. The show is set between Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, the first film, and Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, because in the show they do not have the third child yet. However, the show came out after all 3 films. The first episode aired on September 1st, 1997, and the final episode aired May 20th, 2000. It was canceled after 3 seasons, not because it was performing poorly, but because there was a thing called the 65-episode rule. The 65-episode rule was a controversial rule that applied to all Disney television shows. Now, this one ran in syndication, so that's even more true. But it applied to all Disney television shows, particularly in the late 90s and early 2000s, stating that no show can go beyond 65 episodes, which constituted about 2 or 3 seasons. This rule angered many Disney Channel fans due to the fact that many shows had been canceled while they still had a large fan base. Things like Lizzie McGuire and Even Stevens suffered from that. The cutoff point of 65 episodes may have more to do with programming schedules than any personal feelings about a series on the part of studio executives, because with 65 episodes, one episode could be broadcast each weekday, reaching the 65th episode at the end of the 13th week, 5 times 13 equaling 65. 13 weeks is a quarter of a year, so 4 65-episode shows can be broadcast in a calendar year. But this takes place in between the first two films. I don't know. Honestly, it's been a little while since we recorded the episode. I don't remember how much we touch on the 3 films in general, but it's worth noting. First film was a surprising hit. Then the second film, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, had a bigger budget, kind of didn't perform as well. And then when it came time to make a third film, what they ultimately did is they made it a direct-to-video sequel. Rick Moranis returned. Nobody else from the core cast returned. It was one of the very few live-action direct-to-video sequels that Disney made at this time. You may remember things like Return of Jafar, and Aladdin King of Thieves was direct-to-video. Well, this was a direct-to-video sequel. Rick Moranis returns. He's the only one. It's a real downgrade. Noted celebrity who I hinted at in the episode, Allison Mack, is in the third film, and it's weird. Kerry Russell's in the second one, too. I don't know if I mentioned that in the episode. So it's an interesting lineup. But the show is probably my favorite piece of Honey, I Shrunk media. It finds a family moving to the town of Matheson, Colorado, and has, for the first season, a fully animated opening sequence, just like the movie, which I thought was so great. And they get rid of that in the second and third season for reasons that I don't understand. Obviously, nobody from the movies is in the show. Instead, the role of Wayne Szalinski is taken on by Peter Scolari from Bosom Buddies, and now people have seen him on Gotham, and he won an Emmy for Girls. In the role of Diane Szalinski, Barbara Allen Woods, who most people know from the show One Tree Hill, and will now be in the upcoming continuation of the Chucky franchise on television. Amy Szalinski is played by actress Hilary Tuck, and Nick Szalinski is played by Thomas Decker, who was also John Connor on the Sarah Connor Chronicles. So those are people taking over the roles, and I got to say, they're all a lot of fun. You know, if you watch the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids films, some of the cast can be a little stiff. Everybody just rolls with it. It's also worth noting that Quark, the dog, returns in the show, but for some weird reason, they use a big dog named Matisse in the first season, the actor's name Matisse, and then they replace him in the second and third season with a much smaller dog. I couldn't figure this out. And I don't know if we mentioned this in the episode. I actually used Cameo to ask Barbara Allen Woods, the actress who played Diane Zelinsky, what happened there, and she didn't know either. So I'm going to bounce around a little bit because I took notes on every episode. We're just going to talk about some weird and interesting things that happened in there, and I'll probably trim this down so it's not 9 hours long. I do mention in the episode, I do talk about the grand unified Honey, I Shrunk the Kids universe, because Journey into Imagination with Figment ties the computer that wore tennis shoes into Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. However, in the third episode of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, we find Wayne renting a copy of the computer that wore tennis shoes. So they simultaneously take place in the same universe, and also the film exists in the universe. That's kind of just a stretch you got to do. The show gets very self-referential. There's a lot of references to Bosom Buddies and Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari, despite Scolari being in the show. But I want to talk about this. The fourth episode is where things got real bonkers. The fourth episode is where I decided I was going to watch all of these and talk about this, because the first three episodes are pretty standard. You know, if your premise is a show where a dad can do science and you have experiments and wacky stuff happen, okay, and there's some because it's 97, there's some references. One of their neighbors is an alien conspiracy theorist who's like a riff on Chris Carter, because aliens show up and it goes beyond just the shrinking. But the fourth episode is the kind of weird that could only exist in this era. Fourth episode has a standard plot. At first, Amy, the daughter, who's the teenager, and in the first two seasons, they make her like a very kind of, I don't know, awkward teenage girl, and then they sort of mature her up in the third season, both costuming wise and just character wise. But in this one, she has a crush on her teacher. You know, standard plot you do on these shows, except in this, she uses a time machine that Wayne Zelinsky built to travel back to the 70s to hook up with her teacher when he was a teenager. And she does. So that was the point where I knew we were in for some fun. You know, and then I'll say this. The budget on the first season is a lot higher than the other two. You can kind of feel it. It's a very different kind of vibe. The next episode after that, the fifth episode, introduces that Wayne has a brother, Uncle Randy Zelinsky, also known as Randy Rude, the science dude, who is a spoof of Bill Nye and Beekman. This episode, he's played by character actor Tom McGowan, but IMDb credits Joel McCrary, who would go on to play Randy in future seasons, because the show takes a weird shift. And it's also worth noting, this is another brother to Wayne, because, of course, Wayne's brother, Gordon Zelinsky, is introduced, played by Stuart Pankin in Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves. The fifth episode also has a prolonged sequence in a McDonald's that is insanely pro-McDonald's. Later on, they bring in Academy Award nominee Paul Williams to play a leprechaun. We get to episode 9, and we find out that Wayne's shrink ray and all of Wayne's other inventions are powered by tiny pieces of a meteor he found in college, which he calls Zelinskyite. But the meteor was actually secretly given to him by an alien named Arnox that Wayne first met when he was an adult and traveled back to the Old West to help the alien get home. And then the alien went and found Wayne when he was younger. Their timelines are off, you see. It's like Tenet or River Song on Doctor Who. A lot of weird political references throughout the show, too. It's worth noting. Jokes about G. Gordon Liddy and Rush Limbaugh. Also, a weirdly horny show. Weirdly horny show. You know, in the films, it's very, very chaste. But in this, a lot of references to how much Wayne and Diane, who they emphasize what a jawline Scolari has. Scolari was an athlete, so I guess that makes sense. But they emphasize how in shape the two of them are, and there are so many references to the two of them just going at it. There's an episode in the second to last episode of season one where the Diane and Nick and Wayne's boss all get lizard parts, and Wayne fixes everybody else but Diane, and Diane says, "What about my lizard tongue?" And Wayne winks and says, "Well, we have all day tomorrow for that," and they just start making out. It was a just weirdly horny. Season one of the show ends with a cliffhanger about some type of Men in Black Illuminati organization who are trying to go after the Zelenskys, this is never brought up again in any of the future seasons. So that's kind of left a hanging thread. Also, Amy has a bully in the first season named Tiara, played by Jewel State, who would later play Kaylee Fry on Firefly. We also don't see her again. So it seems like between seasons one and two, they did like a big retooling. I personally like season one a lot. I had a lot of fun watching it. I watched it when I was a kid. And I'll get to that. There were a couple episodes that stuck out to me, but I watched it when I was a kid and I thought it was fun. And watching it again this time, I really enjoyed it. Season one had a lot going on, but I guess they wanted to rework it. So season two changes some things around. There's a new tone that's a lot more dramatic in the second season. Like there's a lot of, I don't want to say Seventh Heaven because obviously that feels weird now, but you remember like those late 90s, like every show had to be like a family show that had like dramatic music and every plot line had to be about like, well, our son's not doing well in school. It does a lot of that. They also introduce a new neighbor called the Chief, who's played by George Buza. Buza, I might not be pronouncing that correctly, but he's a Canadian character actor who voiced Beast on X-Men the Animated Series. Isn't that wild? Anyway. Oh, and he's one of the truckers in the 2000 X-Men movie. I should note that. It's a nice little homage. But he appears as the chief. He is the police chief in the town who lives next door to the Zelenskys, and he's just not having any of Wayne's antics. So you can tell they're trying to give like a bit of a wacky neighbor. The show's a lot less madcap in the second season, which is a bummer. But they also kind of already bit wonky in the second season. There's an extended musical sequence where Barbara Allen Woods is asked to sing Hey Big Spender to distract a general. You start to feel like things are a little off. However, I did find a great episode that I remembered from when I was a kid as I was watching this, which is all these urban legends, Wayne Intense Machine that makes all these urban legends come to life. And that episode was legitimately terrifying when I was a kid. And it turns out that that episode is directed by Stuart Gordon, the director behind Reanimator, who originally conceived the idea of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids before Joe Johnston signed on to direct it. Season 2, Episode 8, if you're a wrestling fan, Brett and Owen Hart appear as themselves for a wrestling-themed episode. Bryan Cranston shows up in an episode that references both Bosom Buddies and Newhart. For the younger listeners, Newhart was the second Bob Newhart show that Peter Scolari was also on. They also do a full Rocketeer homage in one episode, which is obviously a tip of the hat to Joe Johnston, which is very cool. Oh, I should note, in Season 2, Episode 17, I noticed there's a reference to Silence of the Lambs, and it got me thinking, hey, you remember how kids shows used to reference adult things, and that's kind of how we as young people knew what that was. We had like a cultural touchstone on that, right? I mean, there's references to Silence of the Lambs, Dead Poets Society. There were so many things in the 90s that referenced like adult movies that we probably weren't seeing as kids, but then we understood the reference points. Anyway, Season 2, Episode 19 does an It's a Wonderful Life parody to do a clip show episode, but they also have a character who's a parody of the Sandman from the Neil Gaiman comics, who also invokes his brother Death in a reference to Meet Joe Black. There's a lot going on. Also, midway through season two, the actor who plays Wayne's boss, Jennings, is inexplicably replaced on and off for several episodes. I don't know if he was shooting something else or not. But season two, kind of hit and miss. Season three is worth noting because season three, mostly a miss. It's clear that the writing slipped. It's clear they were kind of running out of steam. However, it starts with perhaps the best episode of the entire series, this fun little episode where Wayne is desperately trying to remember a song that he heard on their version of the Ed Sullivan Show called Pop Time. And he'd never heard it. He'd never heard it on the radio. He'd never heard it since. He just remembered that a band came on. They remember that they came on and sang the song. So Wayne travels back in time to go to the theater and hear it performed live. And it turns out that the song that he remembered hearing was only ever performed once by a Soviet group of Soviet spies posing as a British invasion band to brainwash Americans through the song 1, 2, 3, Be Mine. It's very funny. A lot of time travel jokes, really, really good, and it really just kind of elevates the show a bit because a lot of good humor in that. I was delighted by this. But then there's just like weird episodes where they're doing an homage to Melvin and Howard. They start doing a lot of real hacky stuff. There's a real tasteless episode that's a parody of kung fu movies. You can probably imagine where that's going. They start repeating plot lines. They do two different episodes about a criminal who happens to look like Wayne replacing Wayne. It's just real fucking weird. Perhaps second to last episode of season three feels more like a finale than the actual final episode. The second to last episode resolves a lot of plot lines. Amy gets a real steady boyfriend. The chief gets engaged. Most interestingly, Diane reveals that she's pregnant, which sets up the third kid that appears in Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. And the actual finale just involves Wayne writing a detective story and imagining all of the family in roles in a film noir with a guest appearance by Adrian Zmed. It's weird, and it's a weird note for the show to end on, considering they seem to be wrapping it up into that second-to-last episode. I don't know if that's a situation where they meant the second-to-last episode to be the finale, and then they just changed the airing order. But whatever the case may be, it's a weirdly interesting show. I'm surprised it's not on Disney Plus. I hope they put it up, because right now the only way you can watch it is by buying it on YouTube, which I did. Don't regret it, but I'm also not sure how often I'm going to be watching three seasons of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I think it really depends on how long the waning days of the pandemic last. So what I wanted to do to leave you off on this, if you had any curiosity about the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV show, is I'm going to name three episodes that are worth your time. If you are curious about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV show and you're only looking to spend a few bucks to check it out, may I recommend Season 3, Episode 1, called Honey, Name That Tune. It's the one I mentioned above about Wayne going back to the Ed Sullivan-type show and foiling a Soviet plot. It's very funny. It's very clever. They clearly put a lot of work into it. It is directed, however, by John Landis, who is also an executive producer on the TV show. You can figure out why that might be an issue for some people, but the episode is very, very good. If you're looking for another one, Season 1, Episode 5, Honey, I Shrunk the Science Dude is worth checking out. That's the McDonald's heavy one introducing Randy with the Science Dude. That is directed by Savage Steve Holland, who's the director of Better Off Dead. And if I can make one more recommendation, the one that scared the piss out of me as a kid, Honey, Let's Trick or Treat, Season 2, Episode 4, which is directed by Stuart Gordon from Reanimator fame. Those are the three I would recommend checking out. I do enjoy the series. I think everybody's great cast, good stuff. If you check out this episode and you like it, feel free to hit me up on Twitter at NKOAS and tell me your thoughts. This is the part where I should probably plug the show that I do, which is called You're Missing Out. So if you're interested in classic film and trying to figure out why these films are considered part of the canon, please stop by You're Missing Out. Check out the show and subscribe, and we'll be back with Season 2 at some point. I don't quite have a timeline. Thank you guys so much for checking out, sticking around, listening to this. Check out Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV show. It's a lot of fun. Peter Scolari's good. People should put Peter Scolari in more things. I think he's a lot of fun to watch. Anyway, thank you guys for your time. Check out the show. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it.
Podcast like it's 1989. Baby fish mouth. Ethel baby Mammy. Fish mouth.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So
Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.